almost the Canadian national anthem. The border between the U.S. and Canada is scheduled to reopen to fully vaccinated Americans on August 9th. And when it does, standing watch over the crossing at Blaine that day, as it has for almost exactly a century, will be the Peace Arch. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell tells us how the centennial celebration plans have evolved for this monument. And Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Hi, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, everybody knows the Peace Arch. It's at Blaine on the U.S. side, but it actually straddles the border. One leg is also in Surrey on the Canada-British Columbia side. It's surrounded by a lush state park and provincial park that also straddles the border. Now, the monument commemorates the 1814 Treaty of Ghent, which ended the War of 1812 and which set the course for joint occupation of the old Oregon country by the U.S. and British, though indigenous people, of course, had no say in the matter. And it pays tribute to the thousands of miles of undefended border between the U.S. and Canada. It's a 67-foot-tall monument. The idea came for it from the industrialist and good roads promoter Samuel Hill. He's the guy who built those other big concrete monuments. You might have heard of the Mary of Hill Museum or the Stonehenge replica over there near Goldendale. Now, the Peace Arch was delayed by World War I, and then came the Spanish flu pandemic, but it was finally dedicated with a series of events on September 6th, 1921. That's almost exactly 100 years ago. Now, it was built at Blaine because that's where the border is, of course, and Blaine's where the railroad between Canada and Washington went through in 1891, and where the highway was also dedicated in 1921. Now, there's been a number of big events there over the years. There was a big celebration in June 1946 that marked the centennial of the treaty that set the border at the 49th parallel. That, to me, is a perfect excuse to play some old newsreel sound.
Ceremonies at Blaine, Washington, on the border of the Canadian province of British Columbia, mark the centennial of the signing of the boundary treaty between the United States and England. Canadians and Yanks have a cordial get-together at the massive Peace Arch, which commemorates the signing and the 100 years of friendly relations between the good neighbors. A symbol of faith and fairness between two peoples, helping to promote the quest for global peace.
I love the finale sound of the music there. Now, there would have been a lot of reasons to have newsreels like that the past year, you know, leading up to September 6th with the official 100th anniversary, but like so many things, those centennial plans have evolved. Now, the monument's greatest champion is a woman named Christina Winkler. She lives nearby, and she's president of the nonprofit International Peace Arch Association. I first met her 5 years ago when we did a story about the border concerts that actor and labor activist Paul Robeson did at the Peace Arch in the early 1950s. You know, Christina Winkler sees a silver lining in all this, all the stuff that's gone on the past year and a half.
It is, in all honesty, the most visible, most known, and yet underinterpreted international historic site in North America. And so this whole pandemic has just reacquainted people with their park. It has brought people to come to understand it that just thought it was an extension of the border. And so the pandemic itself has done such a great job in informing people about their park.
Yeah, so I don't know if this is exactly a paradox, but you know what she's referring to there, and I'm sure you've heard these stories this past year about couples and families from Canada and the U.S. meeting up there. You know, the unique configuration means people from both countries could mix and meet up in that park in spite of the border closure. And it does say on the monument, along with sort of some symbols, may these gates never close. So for Christina Winkler, who lives and breathes all things Peace Arch, it made a particular impact, and it made her cry more times than she can count.
I've met people from as far away as Florida who have flown in just to meet their family in the park. If you were to walk on one of the weekends in the last 2 or 3 months, you basically would see every culture you could imagine. You would see people with different faith backgrounds, different colors, and everybody coming together for one reason, and that's family. And it just has been one of the most beautiful experiences that I, you know, who's personally has been a part of the parks, volunteering at the park for the last 25 years, to actually see the best of humanity happening right in front of you.
Yeah, so sort of unanticipated way the Peace Arch has served us during the pandemic. Now, humanity means a lot of grandparents and grandkids meeting for the first time, a lot of weddings. For history's sake, Christina Winkler wants to create a registry of all the weddings that have happened there during the pandemic. Nobody was keeping track. Nobody was making anybody register. You know, there was also probably the isolated conjugal visit there, too. Kids, ask mom and dad what that means. Now, the Peace Arch means a lot to Christina Winkler, and we're all the better for her dogged drive and determination to honor and commemorate it. In some ways, she's paying the Peace Arch back for what it did for her a quarter century ago.
It has been my passion, and it has been unintended. I went in to organize the 75th anniversary 2 weeks after it happened. My eldest child was killed by a drunk driver on his bicycle. And so somehow this peace art stuff kept things to do, starting a sculpture exhibit and these going from where we were, it just came natural, and that somehow it helped heal my heart. And so every day that I can bring good into the world is a wonderful day.
Yeah, and so oddly enough, you know, Christina Winkler credits the pandemic for making happen just what she wanted to happen. That's people on both sides of the border to intentionally visit, to spend time, and to make meaningful and lasting memories of the Peace Arch. Memories that are more than just driving by in bumper-to-bumper traffic and waiting to get through customs.
It's not just learning about a piece of history and going, oh, well, that's interesting, gee. It's their personal story. It's exciting to think of where we can go with all of the good for that park and for our relationship with Canada that has come out of this. We truly, truly are some of the most blessed people in the world to share our border, to share our families, and to share our park with each other. Absolutely.
You know, and thinking about this in the future, all those hundreds, if not thousands of people who have had these very special memories in that park because of what we've been, you know, going through the last year and a half, completely unanticipated. But really, you couldn't have designed a better centennial commemoration of what the Peace Arch stands for than how it's functioned that way. I mean, it's really incredible. And, you know, there will be some kind of modest commemoration this year on September 6th. You have to do something on that actual 100th birthday. But Christina Winkler hopes to plan a full season of events for the year ahead, sort of replicate what would have happened for the past year and kind of get back on track with a Peace Arch that has newfound significance for so many people.
I didn't realize it was being used that way. So this is where people, like a demilitarized zone? Where,
yeah, exactly.
Despite the ban on travel to Canada, you could still freely mingle with people in the park.
Yeah, like a duty-free area for affection and love for families and grandkids and grandparents and couples. I mean, it's just this amazing. And it was closed for a while for stretches. Both parks were closed early in the pandemic, so it wasn't always possible. But by late spring and most of summer last year, it was this thing where anybody, like Christina said, people flying from Florida and arranging with Canada's relatives on the north side of the border to come and meet at the Peace Arch Park. Completely unanticipated, but just a really cool piece of history. And to Christina's credit, doing this job, I get to meet people like her who have spent so much of their lives devoted to the history and upkeep of these historical monuments. And to get to spend time with her and then share her story, I mean, this is perfect for me. This is a perfect week for me.
Good. Well, I'm glad that someone's feeling optimistic this week.
Yeah, there's always space, Dave.
That's right. That's what I'd forgotten. There is always space. Our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, all his features, by the way, in case you miss any part of them, are at mynorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen O'Brien, and Chris Elvin, who's going to report on this for this next story for us here. So, it looks like the people in charge, Chris, have had enough of the rock throwing from the homeless camp along I-90 near Rainier Avenue. They're going to clear the camp tomorrow. Now, let's be clear on where the rocks are coming from. Is this from the bridge that is the entrance tunnel to I-90 eastbound?
It's a combination of things, Dave, of the rock-throwing incidents, and there have been close to 200 of them. Some have come from overpasses and not necessarily just right there over I-90. We've had some, obviously, around James Street and other places like that as well. But the majority of the rock and debris stuff is being thrown from the side of the freeway. The side of the freeway,
okay.
Because if you go...
Well, I'm familiar with the camps along the side of the freeway, and I know.
Right. And because of where that camp is along the side, you can basically walk right up almost to the eastbound lanes
or
the westbound lanes.
I've seen people walking along that entrance ramp before, which is
all the time.
Terrifying.
Yeah, and so basically what we're going to see is there are two camps there, kind of along what is Benvenuto Viewpoint there, and then that's kind of on the south end of I-90, and then on the other side, the green space kind of extends, kind of where the Mount Baker Tunnel joins, right? We've got all that green space area. And so it was from this homeless camp that many of the recent rock throwing and debris throwing has been happening. And early on, we had talked to the Department of Transportation. It was like, hey, guys, why didn't you shut this place down? And they're like, well, we don't know for certain that the people are coming there because the access is so easy. Anybody could just walk into that camp and walk up to the side of the freeway. So they didn't want to assign blame. But then the state patrol started arresting people and they all had ties back to this camp. And so they're like, okay, I guess the Department of Transportation has basically said that the camp needs to be shut down for safety. There's enough evidence to say that a lot of the throwing is coming from this camp or people potentially in this camp. So yesterday morning, the DOT, this city and state and the Department of, and the State Patrol basically posted the camp, gave them notice, said, listen, we're going to clear you guys on Thursday morning. That's faster than the normal removal. Normally, you have to give 72 hours notice for these camps. They gave them 48 because they think this is a little bit more urgent. And so we're going to start cleaning that up Thursday. And as I said, I've talked to the State Patrol. I've talked to WSDOT's SDOT about this over the couple of months. And so I talked to the DOT's Bart Treese earlier this year, and I'd asked him a lot of things like, well, can you fence these areas? What can you do to make this to prevent this from happening? He said, there's not really much we can do.
We have fencing in some locations, but that's often compromised and cut. And if someone wants to get someplace, they're going to figure out a way to do it. It's often just a deterrent when we have fencing. But if someone wants to do bad things, you know, really, they're the ones who are responsible and should be held accountable.
So Treese told me it really isn't feasible to fence all of the roads, but they did say that they are going to modify this area in some way, shape, or form to try to prevent this rock throwing from happening, whether that's adding more robust fencing along the side of the freeway. I've always been concerned that how much access you have to the freeway anytime before these camps are even there, that people could just walk right up there. But anyway, that's the situation. The DOT says they will have information when they clean the camp to tell people where they can find help. They're going to have storage lockers available for belongings. And then I said they're going to begin to modify the area to try to keep anybody from returning. Mayor Durkin's office put out a statement yesterday calling the removal of the camp an urgent and serious public safety concern. So it looks like they finally have enough evidence with the Washington State Patrol to close this camp. And let's not forget, yesterday there were two incidents yesterday. Biggest of which was yesterday afternoon around 4 o'clock, where someone came out and hit 7 cars with the rocks, and he was chased down by one of the people whose car he hit.
And where was that? How do you chase somebody down if you're on the freeway?
Well, because you basically park when you run down the Rainier off-ramp. And the state patrol were there on some other related incident, and he basically ran right into the state patrol and gave himself up. So that's at least 3 arrests. I know Heather had reported earlier this hour there have been as many as 5. And so there's been what's interesting about this, David, is the philosophical discussion, because early on we were like, okay, it's WSDOT's property, but it's Seattle's problem. Neither one of those agencies, in terms of the Department of Transportation, are enforcement agencies, so it's up to the State Patrol, and they were all kind of pointing at whose responsibility it was, and I think a lot of people were getting frustrated that finger-pointing was getting in the way of people's safety, and it looks like now they've finally come together and said, okay, we'll try to handle this as a group, and we're clearing the camp.
Yeah. I'm glad. I mean, I understand you don't want to assume that everybody in a homeless camp is a rock thrower.
Of course not.
But once you have the evidence that there are people living in the camp who've been throwing rocks, I guess either the well-behaved people find it in their own interest to police their community, right? Or the outside community is going to have to do it for them, which is, I guess, where we are now. Thank you, Chris. For people living with a disability, having a service dog can make all the difference in navigating the daily difficulties of life. Car Radio's Nicole Jennings tells us about a charity that helps get those dogs to people who need them, and it's our charity of the month.
Training a service dog is no easy task.
Service dogs, we're asking them to pay attention to their handler when they're out in public. Focus on the handler themselves instead of leaving the handler to go say hi to other people or sniffing or barking and growling. Doing normal doggy things, we expect the dogs to behave, be an extension of their handler.
That's the mission of Denise Costanton at Brigadoon Service Dogs in Bellingham. Brigadoon trains dogs to help adults and children with many disabilities, including hearing loss, mobility issues, and diabetes. A service dog can provide everything from help with daily activities to life-saving actions.
If the dog has been trained as a hearing dog, then that dog is expected to alert the handler for somebody calling from behind, for example. If their telephone rings and they don't hear it, then the dog can nudge them. They can alert for timers. If you're cooking, the oven goes off, fire alarms, the dog becomes their ears.
And for a person who has trouble walking, the dog can help prevent them from falling or help them up if they do fall. It can take years and tens of thousands of dollars to get a dog ready for that level of assistance. And Brigadoon's work doesn't stop after they match the dog with a person and the dog goes to its new home.
We are there for them with the service of that dog, the entire life of the service of that dog. So if they have training issues, they're going to go on a trip and they want to know what to do, whatever it is their questions may be, they have an answer.
While civilians do pay a third of the cost of training the dogs, 40% of Brigadoon dogs go to veterans who don't pay a penny. For veterans suffering physical or emotional pain, these dogs can be transformative.
They may not be in a wheelchair or walk with a cane, but they still are hurting, and it gives them something else to think about. And the mere touch of that animal calms them down and gives good endorphins. The dog doesn't judge them at all.
Denise has seen this up close.
One, for example, was a shut-in. He had four children and he didn't want to come out of his bedroom. Once he got the dog, he gave him something else to concentrate on. It just opened up his life again, and he basically went back into being a father with his children. And 2 years later, his wife and he and the dog went on a second honeymoon.
And she estimates that over the years, they've provided about 50 veterans with service dogs. Brigadoon Service Dogs is Cairo Radio's Charity of the Month.
Cairo's Nicole Jennings.
Dr. Andy Margolet, the beloved pediatrician and World War II veteran, turned 101 this past weekend. But after a lifetime of service, he's showing no signs of slowing down. CBS's Nora O'Donnell has your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
All right, all right, all right. Here we go.
He's an old hand at treating young lives.
You're a good baby.
Pediatrician Andy Margolet is 101, but shows no sign of slowing down.
It's a feel-good job. It's not even a job. It's just fun. That's cute.
Dr. Andy, as he is known, is one of only a dozen century-old doctors in the U.S. still practicing today.
What is more important than helping other people?
The World War II Navy veteran had an award named after him for his work in military pediatrics.
That is a molluscum.
He's practiced long enough to know what it was like before vaccines protected us. Long before COVID, another virus was especially lethal for children.
Polio was so bad, the death rate, the kids going into the iron lung, it was awful.
Back then, Dr. Andy was on the cutting edge of vaccine development and cures for childhood disease.
We gave the kid one dose, and it was literally almost the leukemia was gone. That is called gratification. It's cheating to sit down.
It's that lifetime of service to his country and his patients that sustains him.
If you had to put a headline on this thing, I guess you'd say helping people. That's what it's all about.
Thank you so much.
Ageless wisdom from a pediatrician in the infancy of his second century.
Man, he has perspective, Dave.
He does. Joining us direct from the G and Ursula show, which starts at 9. Here's G Scott. Did you hear the David Begnaud piece we played earlier this morning, G?
I did not, sir.
All right. This was an interview with a Louisianian who had COVID and contracted pneumonia and is still in the hospital, hadn't gotten vaccinated. And David Begnaud interviewed him, and here's the clip I wanted you to hear.
Before you got sick, if you would have had a chance to get the vaccine and prevent this, would you have taken the vaccine?
Nope.
So you would have gone through this?
I'd have gone through this, yes, sir. Don't shove it down my throat. That's what's local, state, federal administration is trying to do. To shove it down your throat.
What are they shoving? The science?
No, they're shoving the fact that that's their agenda. The agenda is to get you vaccinated.
So this apparently is the explanation for the vaccine hesitancy. People don't like the government telling them. So I'm guessing if the government didn't tell them they'd do it, that's the part that confuses me. Anyway, do you understand this?
Yes, I do understand. I understand because some of these folks out here have been listening to people that have platforms across the country tell them and give them vaccine misinformation. and tell them things like the government is trying to do this and this is their agenda when they themselves have the vaccine. So, yeah, this is continuing to happen with whether it's someone with a platform, someone that is a politician who are able to get this message out. But right now, today, on this date of 2021, the United States, COVID is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That is what is happening in this country. And the reason why you are seeing Stephen Scalise, you're seeing Sean Hannity, and you're seeing all of these people start to turn things around, because they are realizing, uh-oh, we have a problem. The truth never expires. I say that all the time. You can lie all you want to, but at some point, you're going to have to face the truth. There was a Facebook post by a doctor in Alabama. By the way, the state of Alabama right now is the lowest when it comes to vaccination, those fully vaccinated at 33.7%. This doctor took to Facebook and she was emotional. She says, quote, "I'm admitting young, healthy people to the hospital with very serious COVID infections. One of the last things they do before they're intubated is beg me for the vaccine. I hold their hand and then I tell them, I'm sorry, it's too late." This what's happening right now, 94% of COVID hospital patients right now are the unvaccinated. And in Alabama, 96% of the Alabamans who have COVID have died since April that weren't vaccinated. So I wish that this did not become political. I wish that sheriffs around the country don't say to a crowd of people, don't be sheep when it comes to whether or not COVID is real or if it's a hoax or not. I wish that a lot of people can just maybe go out and talk to your primary care physician. And that's another thing that this doctor said on this Facebook post. She talked about the fact that, here's a quote, "And the one question that I always ask them is, did you make an appointment with your primary care doctor and ask them for their opinion on whether or not you should receive the vaccine? And so far, nobody has answered yes to that question." So I don't listen to me. I don't listen to Dave Ross. Maybe go listen to your trusted primary physician. But if we're listening to people on Facebook, if we're listening to people who've never studied infectious diseases and we're making these decisions, that's why we're in this situation, Dave Ross. And it's a scary thing.
I'm familiar with the phenomenon that people know what they believe before they know the facts, and the facts don't change their minds once they've decided what to believe. And I get that. That's how the brain is wired. I thought, though, that if anything would change somebody's mind, it would be the experience of having been to the brink of death. And if even that doesn't change people's minds,
I think
then we're wasting our time. I mean, you've made your choice.
In all fairness, Dave, I believe that that is a very rare situation, that guy right there. Like, I believe most people change. I believe, and I'll say for me, even in the beginning of this pandemic last year, I mean, all I could do was trust what some of the experts were saying, trust the virologists that we had on our show every single week throughout the year of 2020 and into 2021. All I could do was trust what they said because I didn't know. I didn't experience it. But it took the death of my cousin to say, oh, this is real. So when it really, really impacts you, or you might lose a loved one, or whether it's a friend or a family member, maybe that's then when you might say, okay, it's serious. And hopefully you aren't on the brink of death like this situation right here.
Yeah. One more thing.
Yeah.
Some people have said the reason for our hesitancy is because this is under an emergency use authorization. Do you think that's what it is? That if when the vaccine gets the final approval, then suddenly people will line up and
You know what, Dave? I just recently saw that same thing. I saw the same thing. You know what? Whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. That's why when Sean Hannity came out and said what he said yesterday, the other day, I don't have time to say, well, why didn't you say that before? I said, thank you, Sean Hannity. Thank you. Because of you, you are going to save lives with that. And anybody else that does it. And as a matter of fact, there are so many people within communities. I know we've had people on our show that have wrote us to talk about how important Chris Sullivan was when his message got out there talking about COVID and how they listened to what he said. So sometimes you just never know who might be that one person or with that one message. So in this case, if it takes it being federally approved and this extra bit of approval and somebody decides to get it, thank you. Awesome.
G. Scott with Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. G, thanks. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. And joining us is senior CBS foreign affairs analyst Pamela Falk. Pam, give us the Haiti update. Who is in charge there now?
There is a new prime minister, Ariel Henry, who was designated to be the prime minister just days before the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, was shot dead in his home in Port-au-Prince in the early hours of July 7th. So Henry is now assuming the post, and the interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, is stepping down. And that is in the interest of getting some kind of normalcy to a country where there still is no president, there still is barely a Supreme Court and a justice system. One of the heads of the Supreme Court died of COVID recently, and the economy is just tanked. So the mobs are taking over a bit, and the question of who is behind this assassination is an obsession of both the Haitians and the Americans. There were U.S. military, once-trained Colombians implicated in the plot. The Haitians said today that the big fish involved in the assassination are still at large. And so the news that the Prime Minister, Claude Joseph, stepped down makes way for a new government to be headed by the man that the late president wanted in office. And the change comes, it was decided this past weekend because the international community, a group known as the core group made of diplomats of Europe, Latin America, the UN, and the United States, decided to support Henry, who served in the past as both the interior minister, mm-hmm. the labor minister. But yesterday, CBS News heard from the director general of the International Red Cross saying the economic, political, and social situation in Haiti is dire and is deteriorating.
Okay, is this new guy, does he have generally the support of the people? In other words, should this calm down the mobs?
This should calm down, generally speaking, the political system. But the mobs are based on the fact that there is COVID. There are very few vaccines in the country. There's an economy that is not supporting anyone. And if you remember after the earthquake, all of the money that went into Haiti, it just never, I mean, this goes back a few years, it never got to people. And so there's
been simmering anger there, you're telling me.
Simmering anger, absolutely.
Okay, so what concerns us, of course, here in the U.S. is an influx of refugees from Haiti if the situation
yes.
gets too desperate. So are we anywhere near that happening?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why you heard from the Homeland Security Chief, DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who is a Cuban refugee himself, the family of one, say Cuban and Haitian migrants and asylum seekers who try to come to the United States by boat will not be allowed to enter the country. What they are trying to do, the U.S. government and the Biden administration, is avoid what happened in the 1990s when both Haitians and Cubans, also in meltdown a bit these days, or get into boats, sometimes the same boat, and come to the United States. At that time, they were taken to Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. Now they will be sent back.
All right, so I guess they've got a plan there, but long term, well, I mean, I keep hearing that we have an abundance of vaccine here in the U.S. Would it help if we just started a crash vaccination program in Haiti? Would that pacify people?
That would help an awful lot. And the USAID and U.S. has sent vaccines. It just getting the infrastructure there, getting everything there, getting hospitals going, getting oxygen, all of that is needed. So it will take a great effort by the United States, but that would help. The problem is, even during the presidency of Jovenel Moïse, there were gangs that were starting to grow, and that became the norm for Haiti, and it hasn't gotten any better with the economy tanking and now with the political situation insecure. And so no one really knows why his own guards, by the way, didn't protect him. So anyone coming into office has to worry about their own security. But in terms of the general population, why you've seen these protests, it's also money to the economy. So a massive aid effort has to be made. And the international community is trying to do that. And that's what that core group is trying to do, is to get money from around the world, not just the United States, to avert a mass exodus.
CBS Senior Foreign Affairs Analyst Pamela Falk. Pam, thanks very much.
Absolutely. I wish I had better news, but maybe diplomacy will serve a purpose now.
You can ring my bell. Ring your bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. The new Anthony Bourdain documentary is out. The famous cook-turned-traveler who died by suicide in 2018. Rachel Bell has seen it, but there is a big journalistic controversy about this. So give us the background, Rachel.
So this is a film made by Morgan Neville. He's the same guy who did one of my favorite documentaries, 20 Feet from Stardom. He also did the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? So the controversy is this. The filmmaker, Morgan Neville, he took hours and hours and hours of Bourdain speaking from, you know, TV shows and stuff. And he used artificial intelligence to make him form sentences that he never said. But there are things that Anthony Bourdain wrote down mm-hmm. that he wanted his voice on. So basically, it's 45 seconds, about three sentences of Anthony Bourdain's voice narrating a couple things from his journal that he never said. So it's an ethical dilemma for some. I saw the film a couple nights ago, and if I didn't know about this, I would not have noticed at all. I didn't notice any, you know, different sound, like that he sounded mm-hmm. different in any other
part. It just sounded like Anthony Bourdain reading his own words.
It doesn't seem unusual. But of course, people are upset about this for many reasons. One, you know, was there consent from his family? The filmmaker said that he did ask Bourdain's widow and a couple of his friends and that they consented. But on Twitter, one of his ex-wives said, absolutely not. I quote, I certainly was not the one who said Tony would have been cool with that. There was an article in Vulture about this, or rather Variety, sorry. And the author was saying, yeah, big difference. The author was saying, you know, documentaries have not been pure since the beginning. There are manipulations to story, sequence of events. You know, sometimes they do animation or bring in actors to play real people to create a scene that there's no documentation of and that person is gone. So he was saying, you know, maybe it is just that this is new and we're uncomfortable with it because it's a slippery slope. You know, what is next? So remember years ago, they used holograms at Coachella so that a hologram Tupac could perform with a real Snoop Dogg. And apparently right. there's a Dirt Devil commercial where there's a hologram of Fred Astaire
yeah.
dancing in it. Yeah, I think those are worse, personally.
Well, I think those are probably approved by the estate because you get paid for that. But let me ask you this. Would it have ruined the documentary for you if there had been a disclaimer at the end saying portions of Anthony Bourdain's narration recreated by artificial intelligence?
I don't know. I mean, I knew about it going in because of these articles,
yeah.
and I initially felt very strongly that it was wrong. And after I saw it, I did not care at all.
Yeah.
They didn't put words in his mouth. It was something that he wrote down and they put a voice to it. It was 45 seconds. You know, it wasn't something inflammatory that they had him say. It didn't bother me. But I do think that there is a slippery slope. You know, I mean, this was happening in politics and there was worry, you know, about President Trump doing things like this. So right. I don't know. I think at some point there's going to have to be some kind of regulation. Maybe you have to get some kind of formal approval to do this, because how would you even know that it's happening?
Well, exactly. But more important, there needs to be some sort of watermark, some kind of digital watermark, so you can tell what's true from what's been faked. But we're missing the really important part of this story, which is that you have actually met Anthony Bourdain. So tell us about that.
I did. It was thrilling. So old school listeners of Cairo will remember that my friend and colleague, Dan Recione, and I, we used to do a little segment called Stick a Fork in It. It was a little restaurant review segment. And we saw that Anthony Bourdain was coming to Seattle. He was doing a book reading at the university bookstore. And so we contacted the publisher or something, and we said, can we interview him? They said, maybe, but here's tickets. Come along and we'll see what mood he's in. So we go, we watch the reading. He's extremely compelling, just such a great person to see live. And so afterwards, you know, the contact said, sorry, he's not in the mood for an interview. We really got to get going, but we will tell you, we're not telling anyone else this. He's out back right now smoking a cigarette if you want to go say hello. So Dan was a smoker.
Yeah.
I had quit years ago, but I said, give me a cigarette. Come on, give me one. So we went back there and we had a cigarette with Anthony Bourdain. We probably hung out with him for 15-ish minutes, and it was really fun. And it's always weird meeting a celebrity, because you know, you don't want to just fawn over them, but it's like, yeah, what else do you talk about? You just want to be immediately, you know, best friends. So it might have been later that day or the next day, I got an email from that contact that we were talking with, the bookseller or whatever, and she said, Tony loved meeting you, something to that effect, like he thought you guys were cool. We became kangaroos. We were jumping up and down in the newsroom. This lasted for years, this feeling. Like Dan would call me, you know, I'd be out in the field about to go live, and he would be at the desk and he'd say, all right, Rachel, you're going live in 3 minutes. And by the way, just so you know, Anthony Bourdain thinks we're cool. And we would squeal about it.
Where's the recording of this little interview?
There's a photograph and I can't find it. It's digital, and I know I have it somewhere, but it's a little bit lost right now. But I remember I was wearing green pants. But yeah, there's no taped interview because they wouldn't let us do it. If I find this photo,
I know a film director who can recreate that photograph and maybe maybe even the whole interview.
Oh, that's true. Yes. Come on, AI. Suddenly I'm very in favor of this technology.
Yeah. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
And yeah, this weekend, if you're looking for a movie, go back out. If you feel safe, support theaters. They're not doing very well. Get a ticket to Roadrunner. It is excellent.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.